Great to have you with us for another edition of Garden Talk. I think it's your weekly resource for all things gardening. Larry Mueller here. And Bruce Spangenberg is back with us. He's the statewide horticulture outreach specialist in the Hort program at UW-Madison's Division of Extension. He also writes the weekly gardening column. It's titled Wisconsin Yard and Garden, and you should take a look at it. It's every week, some great information from Bruce. We'll talk to him about the plants that are great pollinators at this time of the year. We've got some fall flowering plants that really work well. And of course, we'll take your other gardening questions as well as we move along. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call, the number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Bruce Spangenberg, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be back.
Lots of insects and butterflies and moths out and about right now, and kind of important to provide food for them right now.
Yeah, I think it's kind of overlooked, and that's why I did that column recently. We've had a lot of nice weather the last couple of weeks, unusually warm, dry weather, a lot of, breezy days, and a lot of things are flying around, including monarch butterflies and other things. So one of the things, people look at pollinator gardens or specifically trying to help monarch butterflies. A lot of times they focus on the larva, planting milkweed and similar plants for the larva to feed on. But the adults have to migrate all the way down to Mexico. So they got a long flight. They need energy. So one of the things you can do to help is to plant plants that bloom here in the fall, starting in late August into September, even into early October, so they can kind of fuel up on their way by providing that pollen and nectar.
Yeah. And we need to place them, for the most part, I think, in sunny locations, right?
Yeah, that's one of the limiting things. Most of the plants that are preferred are going to be full sun. By that we mean usually a minimum of 6 hours of sunlight a day rather than in the shade. But yeah, out in the sun, and especially in the cooler mornings, the insects prefer the sun too. They warm up faster during the fall.
Yeah, well, let's take a look at some of the more popular fall flowering plants. I'm seeing, in my neighborhood, I'm seeing a lot of asters. Right now. And maybe you could talk a little about asters.
Yeah, I think that, the typical one that's on the list for the fall, it's a native, is New England aster. Do you also have the coneflowers? A lot of things, they don't have to be native. That's usually the preference. But, typically, in landscapes, you can have a combination. There's no rule that says you have to have all native plants, but certainly natives are at the top of the list. The asters, coneflower, even some of the annuals, verbena, zinnias, things like that. If you still have them blooming, you'll see that, they do attract a lot of pollinators here this time of year.
A few of my neighbors have sunflowers, and they, I think, are a type of aster.
I believe so. Yeah, it's a big family of closely related plants there, and you're right. There are a number of the sunflowers, traditional garden sunflowers, and some of those are still blooming. Of course, some are producing seed, and that of course attracts the birds to eat the seeds as well. So you get the double impact there on the pollinators, and then on the birds later for the seed.
Yeah, just thinking in general about asters. Is it let's talk soil first.
Yeah, usually you want to have well-drained soil. They're not real finicky, but, decent drainage. Usually the limiting factor is if you got, a lot of clay and you got a soil that stays wet too long. Now, having said that, you can go on our website. We have a list of pollinator plants and native plants. And if you do happen to have an area that is wet, stays wet most of the time, you can adjust that and plant some plants that are better suited to wet soil. But typically the biggest stumbling blocks are going to be too much shade or a soil that's just, really heavy clay, compacted, or maybe it's all gravel, it's in fill, that kind of thing. So you might have to do a little modification with the soil, add some organic matter, that kind of thing that we always talk about. But overall, they're not plants that are real high maintenance plants. The main requirement is good drainage and full sun, or near full sun, so that they have the opportunity to grow.
Are we getting a little late if you consider planting them now? Is that a bit late?
Yeah, I mean, usually, whether it depends if you're going to seed or plant transplants, but typically you're looking at the spring. So that's, you know, one of the things that I mentioned in an article was not necessarily to rush out and try to add something here in the next week or so, but looking ahead to next year, because then you can kind of look at your whole landscape plan. Maybe you got spring flowers, you know, bulbs and other early bloomers. Maybe you got the traditional summer perennials, but now you could add some things in the fall that give you not only the benefit to the pollinators, but also add some extended color to your palette in your landscape, you know, and try to get as much, as long as possible, have some color out there to look at.
Yeah. And they're pretty much, I'm thinking about availability in spring. They're pretty available, are they not?
Absolutely. Yeah. Garden centers, nurseries, whether it be local, whether it be mail order. Yeah, they are. There's a lot of, you know, opportunities, and, you know, we're seeing more and more awareness, more and more people, you know, looking at ways they can help pollinators. So it just helps the nursery industry make these plants available, knowing that they have a market for them. So, yeah, they should be available, but typically looking at spring. So now you're kind of looking over the winter months, planning, which is always the key to a good landscape, and then make those purchases in the spring.
Mark in Arlington has something that relates to this, I believe. Mark, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you're loud and clear.
Okay, up at Goose Pond, now called Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance, is the owner in the state of Madison Audubon. We've been tagging monarchs for many years, and what we did is when we caught a monarch on a nectarine plant, we recorded it. We recorded over 5,700 monarchs tagged on nectarine plants in the fall, of course, this time in the middle of September and September. 50% of the monarchs in fall, we've got all the prairie plants out there, 50% of them are nectarine on showy goldenrod. That's the key plant for them. It attracts them better than any of the goldenrods or asters. It's still flowering, but when that's done, then they're going to go on New England asters. But their preferred one is showy goldenrod. And those are two that come to mind real easily. Some of these are pretty aggressive, like sawtooth sunflowers or nectarine, but I would concentrate on the showy goldenrod. And if you were in your yard early in the migration and that, if people would be planting metal blazing star, like Atrus Ligustylus, and some of our friends have planted that, and the most anybody I've heard of in the fall migration has seen 17 monarchs on one plant. So that's one that you should check out with the garden centers and the prairie nurseries.
Yeah, good tips sure. There, Mark. Thank you for calling. Bruce, you're nodding in agreement with what Mark had to say.
Yeah, and actually all three of those I did mention in that column. But yeah, in goldenrod, sometimes, you know, it still gets a bad rap because people still have that association with hay fever and allergies, which there is no connection. Goldenrod has one of the heavier pollens. It's not windborne. But, yeah, absolutely. It's another plant that very easy to grow, and it attracts a lot of pollinators, no question about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it, and appreciate the research you're doing out there as well. Appreciate that very much. Nick in Fort Atkinson, your turn. Hi, Nick.
Hi, I just wanted to point out, I can't remember the scientific name for it. It starts with a T, but common name is nuts and sunflower. And I've been growing these the last couple of years, but last year my neighbor boy, he's become my little junior botanist buddy, and coming over and checking out the plants and the pollinators through the last couple of years. We were really sad. We only saw a couple of monarchs the whole year last year. So I went crazy this year and planted like 20 of these nuts and sunflowers, watered them, fertilized them really well. I've got like 10, 12-foot plants all over my yard, and we're finding dozens of monarchs on them at a time, not to mention the bumblebees are falling asleep on them every night. It's been almost just magical to see how many monarchs have been attracted to that plant. So I just wanted to bring that up to people. It's a fairly hardy plant, pretty easy to grow. You don't have to even go as crazy with it like I did. I guarantee water it when it gets wilty. So I think it's a pretty good, like, beginner plant to get people you know, to attract some monarchs to the yard and other pollinators as well. Just wanted to bring that one up and say.
Nick, thanks a lot, Bruce.
Yeah, that's another one in the aster family. Yeah, absolutely.
So another good, the Mexican sunflower, another good suggestion.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Susan in Oregon, we'll go to you. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I'm calling about these big areas that people have this pampas grass. Usually it's kind of by the end of their driveway, and I'm seeing it all over the place. And I had something like that in my yard at one time in a defined area, but I started noticing it was invading my native areas, so I got rid of it. And I don't know if I should be bothered when I see this, but I'm seeing it all over the place. People have these big areas right outside their driveway of all this, what I'm calling pampas grass. I'm sure it's not native. And what is your thought about it?
Yeah, excellent question, because that also brings up the whole issue of nomenclature and naming plants. I mean, pampas grass is a common name, and there's probably three or four different species that go by that common name, or sometimes are called that common name. The true pampas grass is actually not hardy here. It's in the south. It has a real white seed head on it. But I know the one you're talking about, there is some invasive. Miscanthus is a genus. Now, Miscanthus sinensis is the one that we do. It is recommended for landscapes. It's not native, but it's also not invasive. But there's also an invasive Miscanthus that's very well suited to low areas. And you'll see it, like you say, along driveways or people planted in a swale or a ditch in front of their property. And then it does spread and it chokes out everything. And it really has no value as far as wildlife and landscape or wildlife and pollinators and that type of thing. It just takes out a lot of the native plants. And that is unfortunate. So it is an education kind of thing. You know, and again, it goes back to knowing what plant you got. Start with by the proper Latin name or scientific name, botanical name, whatever you want to call it, and then go from there. But know what you're planting before you plant it. And unfortunately, sometimes people have planted that because it is easy to grow and it spreads, so it does help control erosion maybe and that kind of things. But the downside is it is invasive and it causes some serious problems. The DNR, if you Google DNR, and also it's connected to our website, you can see the list of plants that are invasive, and it does change. You know, if you go back 20 years ago, there's plants that were recommended that now are considered invasive and are no longer legal to sell. So it is an ever-changing kind of thing. But unfortunately, we do get the invasives. And as you say, most of those are not native. They come from other parts of the world, and they just have no predators, so to speak. There's nothing really that eats them. They don't get diseases, so they readily spread and unfortunately become serious headaches mm-hmm. in the landscape.
Yeah, indeed. Susan, thank you so much. Bruce Spangenberg, our guest today, statewide horticulture outreach specialist with UW-Madison's Division of Extension. He resides in the horticultural program, of course. You can join in with your questions. We've talked about, or we're talking about, pollinators, pollinator plants for fall, but we're obviously taking all kinds of other questions, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Coming up in the second hour of the show, Dr. Death Brian Huddleston is back to talk about the most common plant diseases he's seen this year, and we'll be talking with him about that topic. Right now, Bruce Spangenberg, happy to be with us, I think. No, he always has a smile on his face for Garden Talk. We're dealing with fall flowers for monarchs. We'll talk about some of the other plant diseases that relate to them. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. I lost a big section of my front prairie flower display because of some road construction, and there were a lot of purple coneflowers. I think there's about 2 feet left. But those the coneflowers are another plant, and black-eyed Susans, I think, mm-hmm. as well, that are good fall bloomers.
Absolutely, yeah. Dependable. Absolutely.
Yeah. the black eyes, they a little susceptible to septoria, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, we're fortunate Brian's coming on in the second hour, so
yeah,
he can deal with the disease. But yeah, I think one of the problems you run into when you get stands that are a little bit too thick and they stay wet, you know, a little bit longer, and you do get some of the, you know, septoria, some of the leaf spot diseases that I'm sure Brian will be talking about. You know, obviously, that's been a big disease the last couple of years, especially on lilac. But yeah, sometimes you get into some problems. It might just be a stretch of weather we get. You know, we get a stretch of cloudy, warm weather with some moisture, and some of those diseases have the opportunity. But normally those plants will bounce back. You know, it's just kind of you might get a bad year, a bad stretch of weather, but then the weather reverses itself and things take care, you know, get better. But it goes back to, you know, full sun, like we talked about, matching the site conditions to what the plant requires. Full sun, good drainage are usually the two biggest things we look at to help alleviate or prevent a lot of those problems from occurring in the first place.
Yeah. Deborah and Nina, we'll go to you next. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, thank you. We have a lot of showy goldenrod in our front yard, and we're members of Wild Ones, and we purchased them at our local plant sale in the chapter of Fox Valley. And one of the things that we as an organization are worried about is neonicotinoids. So we've got all these wonderful plants that are attracting lots of bees. Like every bunch of flowers has about a dozen or more bees on them. But now what's happening, you know, with the neonicotinoids in our neighborhood? And I understand that they're even put in seeds from some of the places that you might purchase even native plants.
Yeah. Bruce, comment?
Yeah, again, you know, that came up last time I was on the show also. You know, it's a relatively newer group of insecticides. And, you know, initially they came, as they came about, you know, the pluses were, you know, they were easy to use and they didn't have a lot of drawbacks. But obviously that's changed now because they are, a lot of them are systemic. They get into the plant, they stay there, and they could have an impact on pollinators. So the best advice there is, you know, it goes back to when we talk about managing pest problems. Resist the temptation to just spray without knowing what you've got. You know, try to figure out what the problem is. Look at all the possible ways to manage it, whether we're talking about insects. You know, Brian will be talking about diseases in the second hour today. You know, look at the cultural things, you know, like we just talked about, you know, having the right site conditions, good soil, looking at alternative plants, resistant plants, that kind of thing, to minimize the use of insecticides to begin with. And then if you do need an insecticide, be aware of the different groups, try to use the least toxic, you know, a lot of the things that are more favorable, some of the microbials, like, you know, the Bacillus thuringiensis products that are actually a bacteria. Insecticidal soaps, another one that's very environmentally friendly. It fits into a lot of organic programs. You know, look at all the possibilities. And in some cases, look at just tolerating a little bit of insect damage. You know, sometimes it's not, you know, you look at a plant that's got an insect on it, doesn't mean you have to control it. Yes, it might feed on a little bit of foliage, but knowing what the pest is, knowing what its potential is, it, you know, just live with it if it's just going to do minor damage. Now, the flip side is you have some insects that might spread virus diseases that Brian might be talking about. There's a different case. Or if you're growing a crop and you have a potential insect that can cause economic loss, then you have to take a different approach. But even then, look at your other alternatives as far as insecticide use and avoid that group altogether.
Yeah. How do you pick out, or how do you know when you go to the garden center if a plant might be a neonic plant?
As far as the insecticide, you have to look. The best thing to do would be, and I don't have the whole group memorized of all the insecticides that fall in that group, but the best thing to be would be to look, do some research, find out what insecticides fall in that group. And then if you do encounter an insect problem in your landscape or in your garden and you do need to use an insecticide, look at what insecticides will manage that insect. And if any of them are in that neonicotide group, then make the decision, I'm not going to use those, I'm going to use something else altogether. And I think you're seeing more and more of that when you look into control recommendations, where typically as much as possible, insecticide recommendations are focusing on the least toxic, the least environmental concern, you know, insecticidal soaps, the microbials, that kind of thing, rather than, you know, most of the old broad spectrum insecticides are gone. You know, years ago, you had things like Dursman, you had Diazinon, those kind of things, which have all disappeared. And this next group will probably, the next one to go will probably be the neonics as much as possible.
Deborah, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Tyler in Madison will go to you now. Hi, Tyler.
Hi. I was just wondering if all milkweed is, you know, kind of the same as, you know, for monarchs. We have two really big rose milkweeds that we planted, and I was just wondering if, you know, we should add some other kinds or if rose is good enough.
Yeah, there are several types. That is a good one. You know, the butterfly weed is also a plant that people, you know, monarchs will go to, and other butterflies and other pollinators will go to as well. I don't, you know, you can, again, there's a lot of good resources out there, but what you, again, when you get into the different types of milkweeds, you start getting into that nomenclature that I mentioned where you got the botanical name and the Latin name, and you have to pay very close attention because sometimes the common names will overlap. So if someone just says milkweed, that could actually entail several different species. So that's why we have plant lists like on our website and other places where you can get the actual names, the botanical names, and then when you go to purchase them, whether it be mail order, whether it be a local nursery or garden center, you want to see the actual botanical name of that plant that you're getting so you have the match that you're looking for. But yeah, the rose milkweed is fine. There's other ones as well.
Yeah. All right. Tyler, there you go. Thank you for calling. Susan wonders about garden mums, like the ones we see this time of year in stores. Are they good for pollinators?
They're not high on the list. And again, there's different reasons for that. But one of the things you run into, and this is sometimes we get into debates when we talk about native plants and we talk about cultivated plants and what's happened with a number of the natives, and this includes native grasses as well, over the years, because of popularity, we now have cultivars of the native plants. You know, for example, big blue stem, little blue stem, switchgrass, some of the native prairie grasses, we have different cultivars available. So what happens sometimes when we, when a cultivar, which is a man-made essentially variation of a species, you're trying to look at, you know, through plant breeding, you're picking out one characteristic. Now with mums, typically it's going to be obviously how showy they are, how many flowers they have, the size of the flower, the color of the flower. So it may be features that are going to be at the expense of something like the quality of the pollen. And I know there's been different articles written. There's been research trials done looking at pollen sources, native versus cultivated plants. And you'll see the native plants, like the one caller mentioned with the Leatris and some of the other ones, where you see much higher populations of the insects going to them because it's the plant has not been altered through crop breeding. So that's always a knock on cultivars is, you know, we've altered them in some way. Typically it's going to be visual or, you know, growth habit, color, whatever it's going to be, which might be at the expense of the pollen itself. So, so to answer your question, that's kind of a long answer, but basically they don't have a lot of value. I mean, you'll see insects on them. You know, I've got some mums on our porch and I've seen some bees and things going there, but it's not their first choice. But they, you know, it's a showy flower. They may come to it, but the quality of the pollen and the nectar is not there.
Yeah. The, I think Leatris came up in a conversation during the show, and that's a good native for fall planting and for attracting insects.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's actually one of my favorites. I've got some in my yard. Deer tend to leave them, and that's always the other issue, what do deer eat? Deer tend to leave them alone, but I've had them in one spot for 3 years unaltered and are unaffected by deer, and then one morning I went out there and half of them were gone because the deer showed up and decided to eat them. So just be, you know, we say deer resistant does not mean deer immune. And the other thing is you'll find that rabbits love them, because I, for some reason, have a high population of rabbits where I'm at right now, which I didn't have previously. So now I'm finding the rabbits are eating things that the deer ignore. But Liatris is a great plant because, you know, it does bloom late in the summer. It's got a pretty good extended bloom, very showy plant, you know, very nice, you know, that light purple color, or some different variations available. And it does attract a lot of insects, you know, monarchs, but also a lot of pollinators, you know, butterflies, bees, other things are readily attracted to them.
And another one I was thinking of that I really like is really beautiful, and I can't grow it because it needs a kind of a wet soil, is the cardinal plant.
Yeah, cardinal flower, which is a lobelia. I actually added some this year. I do give them a little extra water. And knock on wood, so far the rabbits and the deer have totally ignored it. So yeah, it's another good one.
and they will get along in partial shade. I mean, they full.
Mm-hmm. But and they do, yeah, they'll tolerate some shade. Not deep shade, but, you know, sun, a little bit of shade, yes. But they do like it a little bit more on the moist side. Very showy, and they do attract pollinators, including hummingbirds.
Yeah, and they're a hummingbird magnet. Mm-hmm. they love them. Dave in Appleton, we'll go to you now. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Judy has planted hundreds of zinnias, many varieties. First year she did that, and they are just a magnet for every kind of a tiny little bee pollinator to a tiny butterfly to monarchs, just everything. So how are they generally, first year doing this, as pollinators? And what about other annual plants for pollinators?
Yeah, as you mentioned, zinnia is right at the top of the list as far as a good annual flower that does attract pollinators. Verbena attract pollinators as well. A lot of butterflies I've seen, especially tiger swallowtails on them. Those are probably two at the top of the list. I mean, the thing, again, some of these, and petunias are a good example. There's all different kinds of petunias. They're well-suited for hanging baskets. But again, I think through some of the breeding, you get the visual quality, but you don't have the attractiveness to pollinators. So you'll get some in there, but not as many. You'll get bees in there sometimes, depending on the variety. But most, again, going back to what we mentioned at the very beginning, full sun annuals, or annuals that like full sun, are more likely to attract insects. And the other basic biology, as far as we go back to a lot of the native plants, yellows and purples, as far as flower color, tend to attract more insects. Those are two colors that insects are readily drawn to. So that's another thing you can look at. But yeah, I would look at zinnias. I would look at verbena. Annuals.
Mexican sunflower is an annual,
yeah,
isn't it?
Right, it is. Yeah, we mentioned that before. Yes, that's another annual. Cosmos, you might get some insects in there as well. Butterflies, yeah, in particular.
Yeah. Dave, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, with your plant question. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And we'll be taking up plant diseases in the second hour of the show. We'll zero in on that for the second hour. But any other plant questions, I hope you'll join in. Evergreen trees are called evergreens because they're always green, except a couple of exceptions, I guess. So should we worry when we get needles dropping for changing color?
It all depends. But the reason I just did that column, because right now we do get what we call seasonal needle drop. You know, I'm up here in the northern part of the state where we have a lot of white pine. We also have a lot of red pine. And white pine in particular, you can go from a tree that's perfectly green, and then like the next day you look at it and suddenly it's got all these yellow needles on it, and you're concerned, thinking, you know, it's got an insect or disease problem. But it is what we call seasonal needle drop. And the best thing, or the best way to diagnose it, look at where the yellow, and they may turn brown, or in the case of red pine, they typically just turn brown. Austrian needles just turn brown, but it should be the inner or the older needles. So if you look at the branch, you'll see, like on the white pines, yellow in the interior, and all of a sudden it stops and you got green as you work your way out on the branch. They do shed their older needles, especially in the fall. White pines are heavy shedders. And in fact, up here now, most of those already have fallen with some of the wind. But red pine, the hang on Austrian, you can see it on Scots pine. You can also see it on arborvitae. But just pay attention to where you're seeing it. You know, if it's just the old needles toward the center and there's a real abrupt change from yellow or brown to green, as I mentioned in that column, it's good news because that is seasonal needle drop. It's perfectly normal, nothing to do. But if the whole branch is dead, or if you're just seeing new growth dying, then that's a Brian Huddleston question for later. But now you're dealing with probably an insect or a disease problem. It could be a needle blight, needle cast. It could be a canker problem. It could be an insect problem. Now you don't have that distinction where you had the old needles suddenly change to the green new needles and you were fine. Now you got something else going on that you probably have to investigate.
Email, going back to liatris and cardinal flowers, do you recommend using seed for those? And if so, when should they go in?
I prefer to start out as transplants just because, you know, when you direct seed in the garden, things get lost sometimes. But some of these do self-seed. Cardinal flower, I believe, will self-seed. I know butterfly weed seed, you know, if you got those pods on them now, they're going to break open and they're going to self-seed. So I would prefer, generally, I prefer personally to start as transplants. And I usually recommend that to somebody just starting out because that way you see the plant, it's bigger. The problem sometimes when you direct seed, things come up, but you also got weeds coming up at the same time. And the seedlings are really hard to tell apart. So you may end up either leaving everything and find out you got too many weeds there, or you're pulling out the stuff you seeded because you thought it was a weed. You know, that's part of the struggle. But once you gain some experience and know what the seedlings look like, then, you know, then you could, obviously it's more economical to seed, in particular, if you're dealing with a large area, you know, if you're trying to restore, you know, a quarter acre or more, definitely then you're looking at seeds as much more economical rather than trying to put in a bunch of transplants, which gets pretty costly.
Yeah. Patricia in Antigo emailed to report that the bees seem to like turtle head. They crawl into the flowers and it's still blooming. Earlier, they were all over the hollyhocks and, of course, Joe Pieweed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another one, Joe Pieweed, that's popular.
But turtle heads, they...
Yeah, I'm not real familiar with those.
I'd
have to do a little background on that.
Yeah, I'm not real familiar with them either, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, and that's another reason, and I know Latin names get difficult sometimes to pronounce and spell, but that's also helps avoid confusion because sometimes you get regional common names that are a little confusing or don't ring a bell, but the Latin name would. And another thing, like, you know, mention, you know, butterfly weed, sneeze weed, Joe Pye weed. Don't be discouraged by the term weed in there because, again, that's a common name. A weed is simply a plant out of place, and those plants are not weeds. They're desirable native plants. But, again, that's, you know, common names are a lot easier to say, a lot easier to spell in regular conversation, and that's why we do it. But they all have Latin names, which are a little more challenging to say and to spell.
All right. Well, I know you've got a column coming up on lawn care. We should probably just mention that. What's coming up with that?
Yeah, I just sent my column. I send out at the end of the week, so it gets published on our website on Monday, and it gets in a number of papers throughout the state. Yeah, I just did a column because, you know, obviously we've had the extended warm weather. We always say fall is an excellent time for lawn care, and I know you had Doug on a few weeks ago. Yeah. And did his annual fall show. But we do reach that cutoff point, and we're at that point right now, I should say, in particular with seeding. Now, people say, well, we're talking about record high temperature today. Why can't I go out and seed my lawn? Certainly you can, but my point is, as you get further and further along into fall, it gets riskier and riskier because we don't know what's going to happen. You need a nice 4 to 6 week time frame there from seeding to get the seedlings up, allow them to establish themselves and then harden off before winter sets in. So normally that cutoff is about September 15th. Now, as soon as I say that, people say, well, I seeded on October 5th last year and it worked. There's always the exception, but playing the percentages, you know, we're already at, what is today, the 3rd of October. So you know, even if you seed this weekend and it's in the 80s, that grass seed is probably going to germinate really fast. But, you know, 2 weeks from now, it could be 18 degrees. Now, hopefully it's not. But so you do run that risk. So I would be really cautious about seeding, especially if it's any kind of a sizable project. I would really wait until next year because it is risky. And then the other thing is fertilizing. Again, we say fall is an excellent time to fertilize. Early fall, first part of September is perfect. Right now, the risk you run if you fertilize your lawn, you may stimulate a flush of growth as we go through October that doesn't harden off properly. And then you get more problems with things like snow mold during the winter because now your lawn's really lush and succulent going into winter. And you get snow mold, you get voles and other things in there. So unfortunately. Now, on the flip side, it's still a good time if you have to address things like dandelions or ground ivy. There's time, you know, they're growing well right now. The key thing is you want those weeds actively growing, which certainly they are, as long as you got some moisture in the soil. So you've got here, you know, this first part of October is a good time still to treat broadleaf weeds. Still an excellent time to core aerate. That's the other thing I mentioned there, especially anybody that's got a sodded lawn that you maybe have some soil issues there, maybe you got some thatch problems. Really the whole month of October is fine to aerate as long as you got moisture in the soil to do so.
Bruce Bangenberg, our guest today, statewide horticulture outreach specialist in the Hort program at UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Questions for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Monday at this time, we'll be taking a look at 50 years of Saturday Night Live with a local podcaster. We also talked to the director of a Christmas romance movie that was filmed in Door County. And then we'll take a look at some of this year's fall movie releases. That's on Monday. Right now, though, we're talking about plants with Bruce Spangenberg, statewide horticulture outreach specialist for UW-Madison and UW Extension. Great to have him with us. Questions, give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. The number is 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@WPR.org. Let's turn to Bob in Spooner next. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, Larry. Calling about gentian, bottled gentian. I saw quite a batch of it this morning, and I don't know if it could be transplanted or not. Blue gentian or bottle gentian?
Gentian. I'm trying to think of how that's spelled. Is it G-E-N-T-I-A-N?
I believe that's correct, yeah.
Yeah. What do you know about it, Bruce?
I know how to spell it. it is on the list. I would suspect... if you want to propagate it, probably the best route to go would be to divide it. I don't know off the top. I have to do some research as far as if there is a seed. I'm guessing there is a seed, obviously, but if there is a process to collect the seed. And that's, again, that's something you can look at. If you do look at ways to propagate, especially the native plants in particular, a lot of them have cold requirements, you know, need to be stratified, which essentially mimics winter. Before they'll germinate. So you might have to collect them and put them into a refrigerator or a cold area to expose them to cold. And then the other thing is some of them have to be scarified. And again, it goes back to how those plants have evolved, but you might have to mix them in sand. Sometimes you have to actually treat them with things like acid to break the seed coat down. So if you are going to use seed, that's just a word of caution with any plant. Again, with the gentian, I'd have to look it up and see. I honestly don't know off the top of my head. But those are the two things you typically look at is, do they need a cold treatment? Do they need some kind of roughening or dissolving of the seed coat before they'll germinate? Because if you don't meet those requirements and just put them in the ground, nothing's going to happen. And then maybe they sit there over a season and that would occur then in the soil. But look those things up. The other thing is, of course, in the spring, as they come up, you can divide them. But there again, knowing what they look like when they come up, being on top of things, because every spring's a little bit different. But then, you know, typically most of those, when they first come up, that's the best time to divide. And when they're small, break the clumps apart, put them right back in the soil.
Yeah, and Bob's in Spooner, so you're not going to be doing that now, probably.
No, usually, you know, there might be one or two exceptions, but usually no. Because the biggest problem is what happens in the winter. You know, if you just, you divide a plant now and put it back in the ground, it may not have much opportunity to reestablish roots, and now it's prone to drying out and soil heaving and those kind of things over the winter. So wait till spring to do that. But with all these plants, do some research. There's so many good resources out there as far as propagation. And once you get the plants established, then you have the opportunity to divide them. You also have the opportunity to collect the seed and repropagate by seed. So lots of opportunities with perennials, with the non-natives as well, but especially with the natives.
Corey in Dodgeville will give you a chance now. Hi, Corey.
Hi, Larry. I have my own native seed and plant nursery, so I can answer, I can give a little more information about propagating gentian. I would guess what they saw out there was probably Gentiana andrewsii, and that would be the blue bottle gentian. And it isn't very common, so I would not recommend digging it from the wild, but you can collect the seed. The seed will probably be ready in about 3 weeks, and it hangs on really well. And then you should go ahead and put that in some moist sand, like make it cookie dough consistency, kind of massage that seed in there, pop it in the refrigerator for 6 to 8 weeks, bring it out, let it warm up, and then it will. Then you can plant it, but it will sit in the soil most of the summer before germinating again then in the fall. It's one of those funny, funny germinators that kind of like the cold, wet, hot, cold before it'll germinate.
Interesting. Corey, thank you very much for calling. Good points there, Bruce.
Yeah, and that was an excellent point. You know, I've been mentioning dividing. I'm assuming these gardeners already have it in their yard and they're dividing. But obviously, as you mentioned, you don't want to go out and start digging up plants in the wild. Collect seeds is one thing, but digging up, disturbing the plant, first of all, you might be trespassing, but also you're destroying that ecosystem there and then causing problems. But yeah, I'm assuming people have them in their yard and they're transplanting and dividing their own when they are digging plants up. But there again, that's one that's, yeah, as she mentioned, it's got quite a few things to keep in mind there if you do want to have success. And there again, you have to do some research and figure out what these plants need. It all goes back to how they evolved and how they survived the winter and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Corey, thanks again. Appreciate it very much. Monica in Glendale emailed to say that the Latin name of turtlehead is Shalom obliqua. And yes, the bumblebees love to pry them open and crawl inside.
There you go.
There you go. You did a story on recycling yard waste.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that for helping your soil.
Yes. You know, backyard composting, you know, a couple things. Obviously, you're dealing with this time of year a lot of plant material as you clean up gardens, and obviously you got leaves falling off the trees and that kind of thing. So it's really two benefits. One is you take care of the waste. And then the second thing is the finished product, which is compost, is an outstanding soil amendment. You know, we always talk about amending your soils. So, you know, the basic rule is you mix green and brown together. So green would be things like, you know, grass clippings is a classic, or fresh green clippings off of any plant. Or if you harvested carrots and you got the green tops, that, you know, the leaves, that kind of thing. Brown, obviously leaves falling off plants, dead plants, annuals, dead vegetable plants, that kind of thing. If you chop them or shred them, you know, the smaller the better, because really what you're trying to do when you compost is you're trying to make a really good environment for bacteria, the aerobic bacteria, which are the oxygen bacteria. The smaller the material, the more surface area there is, the faster things are going to decompose. So you mix these together, add enough moisture, kind of the consistency of a wrung out sponge, and then enough volume, typically need about a 3x3x3 pile to get things going. So composting is not, you know, year round, but especially now, it's, if you haven't done it, it's a great time to start because you have a lot of material available. And, you know, the basic rules are just mix the materials together, make sure there's oxygen available, and avoid kitchen scraps and that kind of thing, meat, you know, fat, that kind of thing, because that's gonna not gonna decompose well. It's gonna attract animals and critters you don't want in there. But the normal composting process with oxygen does not have foul odors. It's a fairly fast process. And the finished product is compost, which is essentially the same thing as when we talk about soils, we talk about humus, which is the organic fraction of the soil. They're the same thing. So you're just adding more organic material to soil, which is great for clay soils. It's also great for sandy soils. You know, clay soils are too dense. They hold too much water. Sandy soils, the opposite. They don't hold any water. Compost works both ways. Organic material works both ways to improve both the sandy and the clay soils, as well as the soils already that are in good shape. You're just adding more organic material, which is, you can't go wrong by doing it.
No, you can't. Amy in Mequon has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Amy.
Yes, hi. I'm wondering what the correct name for our native thistle is. I've looked it up. I couldn't find it. And I know that it's good for the finches, and I'd like to grow it and have it available.
Yeah, I'm drawing a blank on that one. I'd have to do some research on that. I mean, obviously, you've got all kinds of thistles, which most of them, you know, it's usually the opposite. People want to get rid of them. But yeah, I'm not sure what the, quote, native thistle would be. There are several, but I don't know offhand exactly which one it would be.
Mark emailed that his Aurelia cordata Sun King Golden Japanese spikenard turns brown stem by stem each year, cleans it up. It cleans the area up every fall, and the plant returns every spring. And this happens to other plants in his yard and neighborhood. Is this normal?
Most likely, yes. And that's an excellent question, because that's another thing when you bring in a new plant to your landscape or your garden. At first, you may think, well, something's wrong with this plant because it's doing that. You know, bleeding hearts are an excellent example. You know, they're blooming early in the spring, got all kinds of foliage. They look great. You look at them by the end of summer, you think they got a disease because they're all turning yellow and disappearing. That's part of their cycle. You know, a lot of the early bloomers do disappear by mid to late summer. So there again, I would do some research with the plant, because most likely if you're seeing it every year and it keeps coming back and looking fine and then later it looks terrible, that is normal. It's part of its life cycle. The problem is when the opposite is when they're supposed to be blooming and they're wilting and browning, then that's a Brian question. Again, you got something going on there that you got to address. But I would first look at what's normal, the life cycle of that plant, because not all plants come up in spring, you know, in May, flower or persist over the course of the summer and then fade away now. Some of them faded away 2 months ago. That's part of their normal cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. Your articles, Wisconsin Yard and Garden, those are really good pieces. I just, when I was searching, I just typed in Wisconsin Yard and Garden article, and it was the first thing that popped up on my search engine, at least.
Yeah, I think it does. I enjoy doing it. Like, again, it's a weekly, it's on our website. It's in, I'm not sure the exact number, somewhere like 36, 38 papers statewide. We send it out, but yeah, the idea is it's timely, you know, things that are going on either problem wise or things you should be doing in your yard and garden. You know, I try to put them in there. I enjoy doing it and I do get a lot of positive feedback on it. So thank you.
Yeah. It's a great service that you're providing, Bruce. And thanks so much for taking an hour to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I always enjoy coming on the show and hearing what people have to ask. So yes. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Bruce Bangenberg, statewide horticulture outreach specialist in the horticulture program at UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Had another email from Janine in Port Edwards. We'll get to that. I think it's a plant disease question. So coming up, we've got Dr. Death to talk plant diseases, and that'll be next. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Stay with us. Thanks for joining in to Garden Talk today. Larry Mueller here. We're turning our attention now to plant diseases with Dr. Death, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Great to have him back. And I hope you'll join in. What plant disease questions are on your mind or maybe in your garden? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Brian Huddleston, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me again.
I was thinking back. You've been associated or directing the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. It's got to be more than 25 years.
27, July 1st of this past year, yeah. I'm hopefully make it to 30 years. We'll see.
Well, every year it's probably a little different every year, but has this been a good year for plant disease?
Well, based on the number of samples I've gotten in the clinic, it hasn't been that great, but it's been weather-wise, I think, a really good year. It's been very wet in many areas of the state, and that's oftentimes what I look for, to see a lot of disease problems. And there are certainly things out there. It's just that that hasn't translated into an excessive number of samples coming into the clinic. So I think it's been a good year, certainly better than 2023, where it was really dry and hot, and we didn't see a lot of disease at all that year.
Hmm. Janine in Port Edwards emailed, the last 2 years, two very mature lilacs in her yard, as well as her neighbor's yards, have lost leaves after flowering. The leaves turn black and fall off. While the branches are not dead, the tree will again sparsely leaf out and produce a small amount of flowers, which is currently happening. Any idea what's happening and how to treat?
Yeah, my best guess for what they're seeing is a fungal disease called Septoria leaf spot or leaf blight. There are a lot of Septoria fungi out there in the environment. The one that people most commonly encounter is Septoria leaf spot on tomato, which causes defoliation from the bottom of the plant up. And there's just another species of the fungus that will infect lilac shrubs. And again, if you watch very carefully as the disease progresses, it'll usually start at the bottom of the shrub and kind of move its way up towards the top, and that'll cause a lot of browning or blackening and cause defoliation. And in terms of management, my two major things that I recommend to people is really good cleanup of any of that leaf debris from the shrubs. You need to get rid of that before the shrubs leaf out the following growing season. You can burn that if it's allowed in your area, bury it, so cover it entirely with soil. Hot compost it if you're a good composter. If you do what I do and just have a pile of stuff in the back of the yard, that's not a compost pile. That's an inoculum generating pile to create more diseases the following growing season. But if you're a good hot composter, you can compost this material. And then the other thing that I really recommend is that oftentimes people plant lilacs and just kind of let them grow, but they do need some maintenance. So regular thinning, and that will open up airflow into the canopy of the shrub. And that tends to help dry things out. So if the leaves get wet, they'll dry more quickly if you've got a less dense canopy, and that can help reduce the disease as well. If it becomes a recurring problem, there are some fungicide treatments you could consider to use, but those tend to get rather cumbersome. You have to make a lot of applications, start very early in the growing season. So I don't recommend that to start off. I think these cultural things like good cleanup and thinning will be probably adequate in most cases. And if we get a drier summer, you'll see less of this disease.
Yeah, and Janine's got two very mature lilacs, she says. And if she hasn't done any pruning, get those, maybe a third of the biggest ones, cut them right at the base?
Yeah, that's the normal recommendation. And again, what you'll typically also see not only is lower disease, but also you'll probably increase the amount of flowering that you see, because the lilacs tend to bloom a little bit more on new growth.
Sue in Waupaca has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Sue.
Hello. I've been struggling with my onion sets getting diseased about July. And no matter how much I rotate my crop, clean up everything, garden organically, I see more and more of the set onions every year being afflicted, and then they rot after I dry them on good racks out of direct sunshine. I understand soft rot is something that's relatively new. Can you tell me anything about this problem?
Yeah, soft rot is been around forever. It's a common issue, but oftentimes soft rot is not the first thing that happens to the plants. Soft rot is bacterial. There's some bacteria that can enter into the plants, and they digest the pectin in the plant, which is kind of the glue that holds the plant cells together. So it just causes the plant tissue to kind of collapse and turn into mush. But again, those bacteria are around in the soil. They're pretty common. So if you're having soft rot problems, oftentimes there's something else that is initiating the issue and providing entry points for that bacterium to get in. This is one of the things where I'd really need to see a sample in the clinic to be able to give you a good idea of what's going on. There is a fungal pathogen called Fusarium that can cause some rot issues in what's called the base plate of the bulb. So there's a little kind of a flattish area at the bottom of your onion bulbs where the roots come off. This fungus kind of attacks in that area, and then that can provide entry points for these bacteria that will further rot the bulbs. There's also, actually, I see it more commonly in garlic, but it does go to onion as well. There is a nematode called bloat nematode or stem nematode that can cause problems in onion. And again, that these are little worm-like structures. They're microscopic, that will tunnel into the bottom of the bulbs. And then again, that can provide entry points for other organisms to get in and do additional damage. There are also some other bacterial pathogens that can get into onion bulbs as well. Those tend to enter through the leaves if there's some sort of physical damage, and then they'll travel down the leaves into the neck and then into the bulb and cause decay. But again, all of those, to try to tease out exactly what's going on, I'd need to see a sample in the clinic. And if you go to my clinic website, pddc.wisc.edu, there's information there on how to submit a sample.
There you go, Sue. Thank you so much. And that website, by the way, I mean, if you want an education on plant diseases, that is here in Wisconsin, that is a very good place to go. You got tons of things on that.
Yeah, that's kind of my baby. I've got a lot of content on there. So if you want to learn about diseases, we have fact sheets on all of our diseases. And if you really want to go the extra mile, I've actually written quizzes for all 130 plus fact sheets, and you can take the quizzes. And we've set it up so that once you get 100% of the quiz, we automatically email you a little custom designed electronic medallion for each fact sheet. If you're into Lego and that sort of thing, I have building block plant diseases. So plant disease models made out of that you can create out of Lego pieces. Those are on there. That's, I think, something fun that kids might be interested in. My book, my limerick book, is up. There's stuff on that. I do weekly summaries of what I see disease-wise in the clinic, so that's up there as well. So, yeah, I put a lot of effort in that. So it's a fun thing. And also check out, I do monthly talks. And if you're interested in learning more about plant diseases, Wednesday evenings, once a month, I do a talk. Coming up, I think, for September, maybe evergreen. Oh, no, it's houseplants, I think, in
October.
Well, yeah, October instead of September. Running behind here.
Well, I tell you, it's an amazing site, and I commend you on all the work you've done on it. It's wonderful. Dan in Mount Horeb has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Hi there. So I have some rhubarb plants that keep dying. I've moved them around three different places in the yard, and the leaves turn a little yellow, and then they get round circles in them, and then the leaves turn brown, and the stem gets mushy. Any ideas for preferably organic control, but not necessarily?
Yeah, the round little spots on the leaves, I wouldn't worry too much about. There's a disease called ramularia leaf spot. It's a fungal disease that I sometimes will see on rhubarb. If you're having problems with the plants kind of declining and kind of that mushy sort of problem, it's probably a crown and root rot of some kind. And those, the way you deal with those is select a new spot on your property and buy new rhubarb plants and replace your old ones. Do not move those old plants from one location to another. That you'll actually move the disease-causing organisms around. So again, given that we've had relatively wet weather the last couple of growing seasons, probably more so in 2025 than 2024, but we've had a fair amount of water. Root and crown rots are going to be pretty prevalent. And that's the one typical disease that I see in rhubarb, and that'll cause stunting and dieback and eventual death of the plant. So new plants, new location. And then if you start to see them decline again, then again, repeat that process.
Yeah. Sounds like he's done a little of that already. But Dan, there you go. Thank you so much for calling.
The one thing, it sounded like Dan may have moved plants from were symptomatic from place to place. So that's the thing you want to change and start off with brand new plants.
Don in Cottage Grove, your turn. Hi, Don.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. We've been growing squash, three varieties, summer, butternut, and acorn for years in rotating around our 4,000-square-foot garden. However, this year, the acorn squash grew to full size, but it's ghostly white. It's not green at all. It's all of them are all white. And the butternuts, instead of turning the normal tan that they turned orange. And the summer squash looked like something out of a primal forest. They grew really ugly. They're not yellow at all. They're full of bumps and multicolors. What happened, if you know?
The bumpy one is an easy one to answer, and I do have some kind of follow-up questions for you as well, but let me cover the bumpy sort of fruits. That's probably a viral infection of some kind. I just had a sample that came into my clinic. Somebody brought in, I don't remember what type of squash it was, but it was a squash, and it had blotchy color on the fruits and lots of warts or bumps, and that particular sample tested positive for a virus called squash mosaic virus, which is moved around by cucumber beetles, of all things. You can also mechanically transmit it on tools. As you cut through an infected plant, you'll pick up contaminated sap. And then if you cut through healthy plants, you can transmit the virus that way. There's not much you can do about that other than to try to control the cucumber beetles. That would be what would likely introduce the virus into your garden. Now, is the white uniform? Or is it kind of blotchy and powdery?
No, it's uniform.
Okay. Boy, that sounds really weird. Have you harvested any of those fruits and seen what they taste like?
We haven't yet, but that's on the list for this weekend.
Okay, I'd be just curious to see if there's a off color or off flavor to those squashes. You know, if it were more powdery, there is powdery mildew, although I usually don't see a lot of that on squash fruits. Definitely you get powdery mildews on leaves on squash, which can be a problem on occasion. There is a disease called Plectosporium blight, which is another fungal disease that will cause whitish discolorations. But typically with that, you'll get whitish spots, kind of elongate, but you can get a lot of those to the point where there'll be a fair part of the fruit surface that will be white. But again, it's a little bit powdery as well. I'm almost wondering if there's something genetic or fertility related with that particular problem. And then what was the other one you said? There was another kind of discoloration issue. You mentioned
on
the second one.
Butternuts all came out orange, and they're smaller than they normally are.
Yeah, I'm just wondering. Again, I'm wondering about seed source. Where do you get your seed?
Locally, Deerfield Nursery.
Okay. I mean, I'm wondering if you might have gotten some mislabeled seed. That can sometimes happen, or if there are problems in the breeding of the seed, because oftentimes these are hybrids, that can lead to abnormal looking fruits as well. Given that it's so uniform in those first two situations that you're talking about, I'm a little bit disinclined to think it's a true disease, like there's a microorganism there that's causing the problem. But definitely with those bumpy, blotchy looking fruit, that's probably viral. it's about the best I can do for you. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I can't be more specific.
I wonder if there could be some drift, chemical drift, if Don's out in the country.
Yeah, I would expect to see growth distortions probably in the leaves and some leaf issues if that were the case. And I guess there are certain of the herbicides that will cause some kind of yellowing or lightening of color. But I'm almost wondering if it's a genetic.
Yeah.
Genetic. And actually, sometimes there can be genetic issues that are heat induced, and it was pretty hot this summer. So there are a variety of environmental things and genetic things that might cause those sorts of symptoms.
Don, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Talking Plant Disease with Brian Huddleston. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Just a quick reminder, we have a book club book coming up on October 16th. The book is titled Beyond the Flames and written by Greg Renz, and there's still plenty of time to read it. And I hope you'll join us on October 16th for that book club book. Right now, we're talking plant disease with Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's turn to Carol in Appleton next. Hi, Carol.
Hello. I have a question about my arborvita, and I noticed in the past 3 weeks, it's beautiful. It's like a natural fence on our backyard, and it's about 30 feet tall. It's always been just great. I noticed in the last few weeks, it's starting to turn brown from the inside out. I just went and looked at the I don't know if you call them leaves, needles, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So the outside of the branches, still very green. The insides are turning quite brown.
It could be something called seasonal needle drop. This is a natural loss of needles, and the two evergreens where I see this are arborvitaes and also white pines. And because as the shrubs grow and produce new needles towards the edge of the canopy, you're shading a lot of those interior needles, so those needles really aren't very efficient for the plants to photosynthesize. So they will shed those needles naturally, and it oftentimes occurs in around early to mid-September. So the timing that you're talking about is pretty typical for that. And in particular, if the browning that you're seeing, or it may be kind of an orange color, if that's pretty vibrant in terms of the color, again, that's usually a clue to me that it's probably this natural needle loss. If the needles at the edge of the branches or at the tips of the branches look fine, if the shrubs look pretty dense in terms of their canopy, I wouldn't be overly concerned about this. Again, it's probably just a natural needle loss. It's equivalent to when deciduous trees like maples have their leaves turn color in the fall and drop.
Yeah.
And again, we'll see this on white pines as well. And what you see there is that the older needles will turn this brilliant yellow color. I mean, it's not that sickly yellow that you associate with the disease problem. It's just this vibrant, vibrant color. Mm-hmm. And again, it tends to show up about early to mid-September.
All right, Carol, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Barry in Madison next. Hi, Barry.
Hello.
Barry, hello. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, what's on your mind?
I've got a Japanese tree lilac that has been declining for several years now. The leaves just don't look right. One side of the tree is looking worse than the other. Small branch dieback. I'm getting shoots from the base. And something that concerns me is it's planted right next to where I used to have a contorted hazelnut, which most have died back to the root, to the graft. That grew up into a 15 or 20-foot hazelnut, which then died back over a period of years. And so I wonder if those two are connected via the same disease. Right, so that's my question.
Okay.
The fact that you're, let's focus on the lilac first. The fact that you're not seeing relatively rapid dieback and death of the tree suggests that it's not the kind of number one disease that I tend to see on Japanese tree lilac, which is verticillium wilt. It's a fungal disease. It infects through the roots, colonizes the water conducting tissue and blocks it off, and that'll lead to a lot of branch dieback, but it's very rapid. And you will get kind of a sectional dieback of the tree, but eventually it'll kill the entire tree. It sounds like this has been a slower process, and verticillium wilt tends to progress pretty rapidly. One thing, and you're also talking about getting kind of shoots coming up from the base, that suggests some sort of maybe constriction in the lower trunk of the tree. So it definitely looked down towards the soil line and see if you see any evidence of a root flare. So looked at the trunk to see whether it widens out as it enters the soil. If it doesn't have that flare, if it looks kind of like a telephone pole as it goes into the ground, I wonder a little bit about whether it was planted too deeply. You might have some girdling roots that are causing problems. These are roots that instead of growing outward from the trunk of the tree will grow around the trunk. And then as that trunk grows bigger and bigger, it'll eventually come into contact with those roots, and that will constrict the water conducting tissue under the bark, and that prevents water movement from the roots up into the upper branches, and that'll cause a slower kind of decline and dieback, which is kind of what you're describing. Also, if the tree was bald and burlapped when it was planted, if the burlap wasn't removed, if the wire basket that was underneath that burlap wasn't removed, that can cause some constriction of the roots of the tree, and that might cause some decline as well. I would check on those. I think those are likely possibilities for what might be going on. The other thing, if you've had a lot of rain in your area, would be possible root rot issues. In order to evaluate for something like that, though, that requires a lab diagnostic. And if you're interested, again, you can visit my website and find information on how to submit a sample or drop me an email, and I'm happy to kind of walk you through that process. But those are some things that might be going on with the lilac. With the hazelnut, the common disease that I see on that is, and this would be on European species, kind of the non-native hazelnuts, would be a disease called Eastern filbert blight. It's fungal, and the fungus is quite aggressive on the non-native hazelnuts and will cause a branch dieback and eventual death of the plant. But you could get sprouting from the base, from the rootstock, and end up with, you know, like you said, a larger size tree. And again, oftentimes those rootstocks will produce branches that are susceptible to infection. And so you'll get dieback again, even on that regrowth. So those are some things. If you're interested in reading up on Eastern filbert blight, I do have a fact sheet on that that's available on my website. If you'd like to learn more about verticillium wilt, we have a fact sheet on that as well.
And that's at
pddc.wisc.edu. Or you can just do a search on the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, UW-Madison, and that'll pop it up as well.
All right, Barry, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Wendy emailed. She bought home a weeping redbud. It looked fine last summer, but this year the leaves came out normally, but have had very pale with a lot of speckling, as though it's been sprayed with small, pale paint droplets. The leaves have not fallen, but just don't look good. Any thoughts?
That's a hard one. That's another tree that's susceptible to verticillium wilt, but the symptoms that you're describing wouldn't be consistent with that disease. I do see on red buds kind of a physiological speckling of leaves. Nobody's really been able to figure out that it's a true disease where there's a microorganism involved. And sometimes you will get spots on the leaves and it'll be kind of speckled, but usually those spots are kind of brownish. You indicated that these were kind of whitish in color. Is that correct, Larry?
I think yes.
Okay. I'd worry it, depending upon where you're located, there are certain chemical drifts that could cause kind of whitish, ghosty sort of spots.
She said
on the
pale.
Leaves.
Yeah,
pale. Might be some chemical drift from someplace nearby. So it looked to see whether someone had sprayed. If you're out in an agricultural area, sometimes when nitrogen sprays are made on agricultural fields, those materials can drift. And if they land on leaves, they'll cause kind of pale spots on the leaves. I can't think of anything from a disease standpoint that would cause that. Usually if sometimes you might see viruses that might cause symptoms somewhat like that, but more commonly it's blotchier. They're not real pale. They're more blotchy, dark green, light green on the leaves. Sometimes you'll see ring spot patterns due to viruses, but it doesn't sound most likely like a true disease where there's a microorganism involved. Be nice to see some photos of that, because that would might help jog my memory on something else that it might.
She may have some photos. Wendy may have some. If you do, send them into the lab. And
Yeah, definitely send those in to me, and I'll take a look and give you my best guesses what's going on.
Randy in Tomahawk will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Randy.
Hi. What I have is we've got a couple apple trees. One is a good one. And the other one is one I can't pronounce the name. It's Wazoo or something. That's what we call it. But anyhow, they're both fruiting very well, and well, the good one is just about finished up. But they have the other one has got like a reddish brown spots on the skin of the apple, and it doesn't go into the flesh. If you peel the apple, it's fine, and they taste good. Everything is normal, but they're sprinkled with these spots all over the skin. And I was just wondering if Brian could help me out.
Okay. Yeah, there could be some diseases. There's also kind of a physiological issue that it could be as well. Sometimes you can get, there's a fungus called alternaria that will infect through what are called the lenticels. They're little air exchange openings that occur on fruits and branches and that sort of thing. And they'll infect, and you'll oftentimes get little, the infections don't go very far, but you will get sort of a red discoloration sometimes on the fruits. If these areas are a little bit sunken, but again, very shallow, like you're describing, there is a disorder called bitter pit or cork spot. And it's kind of a calcium related issue in apple fruits, and it'll cause small localized areas that are usually sunken a little bit darker, so they could come across as looking kind of red. And like you mentioned, they're very superficial, so if you peel the apples, you just don't notice the damage once the apples are peeled. And again, if you want to read more about that, I have a fact sheet on that on my website. Oftentimes it's a difficult problem to deal with, because it's very environmentally dependent. And if you know, we can't really predict the weather. I wish we could, but we can't. And without being able to predict what may be going on in terms of environmental conditions, it's hard to predict whether you'll have problems with that. But as long as you're happy just peeling the fruits and eating them without the peels, I would say don't worry about that, and use your apples that way.
Randy, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. I'd heard of another apple disease that's been going across the Midwest. Oh, now I can't think of the name of it, but it's a relatively new one. And as I remember,
probably Marcinina blotch. Is that the
name? That might have been it.
Yeah, it's a fungal disease. Looks very similar in many ways. You can kind of misdiagnose it as apple scab. So it causes a lot of leaf disease. Defoliation can also infect fruits as well. And I talked with Leslie Holland, who's the extension fruit pathologist in my department, about that, because I think I saw that disease for the first time last year. I'd read about it, but never seen an example of it. And one came through the clinic, and I've seen several this year as well. And Leslie and I were discussing that, and we think maybe that has become more prevalent because people, one of the things we recommend to folks when they've had a lot of apple scab problems is to plant apple varieties that are resistant to apple scab. And when you do that, then you don't have to use as many fungicide treatments for control of that disease, but those same fungicide treatments were probably keeping the Marcinina in check. So with the lower fungicide use, now this disease is becoming more prevalent.
Hmm. Sue in Verona has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Sue.
Hello. Hello. I have a question about a variegated silver maple tree. We have noticed that the leaf edges turn brown every year about midsummer. Sometimes the leaves will even drop early. This year they seem to have hung on the tree. They're dropping now. But also noting that I believe this is kind of like a grafted tree. And so there are parts of the tree that have like basically green maple leaves. And those always seem healthy. So we're wondering what's going on with that tree.
Yeah, it's probably a function of the variation, a variegation of that whitish tissue tends to be a little less tolerant of sunlight and heat. So you tend to get sunburn in those lighter areas. And as you mentioned, you get reversions. That's a genetic mutation in the tree to get that variegated sort of look. And the trees, that mutation is typically somewhat unstable. So you'll get reversion of certain buds back to the wild type, which is a fully green leaf. And those leaves tend to be more vigorous. Those branches will tend to take over if you don't prune them out. But those variegated leaves, you see this in variegated plants in general, is that whitish sort of tissue tends to be more sensitive to sun and heat. And so you will get browning of that tissue. It's not a disease problem per se. It's just a vagary of the genetics of the plant. So you'll have to kind of tolerate that if you like the variegation.
Yeah. Sue, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too, get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234. Here's a couple of emails that are not necessarily related to plant disease, but maybe we can help out here. Donna emailed to ask if she can burn invasives or aggressive weeds like gout weed, or that's called bishop's weed, I think, creeping Charlie Vink. She has a dozen black garbage bags full. I don't know what to say about that. Well, you can't burn in a lot of places, so I...
Right. You need to check your local ordinances to see whether that's a possibility. That this would be a question for Mark Rentz. I think in many situations, you probably could burn that material, but you do have to be somewhat careful. There can be situations where that can go awry. So that would be something, if that person could actually pose that question, there's a, through our Extension Horticulture website, there's an Ask Your Gardening Question section. It's in the main menu on that page. If you just do a search for University of Wisconsin Extension Horticulture, you'll get to that page. And then in the main menu at the top of the main page, there'll be Ask Your Gardening Question. Click on that. You fill out a form. It's a free service. And then that will go to one of our horticulture extension staff, and they'll most likely consult with Mark Rentz, who's one of our weed specialists, about whether that would be a good idea or not.
Good points. Let's go to Eric in Madison. Eric, hi.
Hi. So I have a bunch of peach trees in my front yard, and the main peach tree that came with the house, the big peach tree, had peach leaf curl this year. And I'm wondering what I can do to make sure that I don't have peach leaf curl next year.
Yeah, the typical thing, this is an interesting fungus, because lots of times, as if you've listened to what I've been recommending a lot with some of the leaf diseases that we've talked about, it's, you know, clean up that leaf debris after the leaves fall off the tree in the fall. And interestingly, for peach leaf curl, that's not a good strategy for dealing with that disease, because the pathogen doesn't really overwinter in the leaf litter. It actually overwinters on the branches and the buds. And so you need to make fungicide applications and to kind of knock it back. And usually you wait until after the trees have defoliated in the fall and either make an application after defoliation in the fall or one before the trees leaf out in the spring. You can use a copper-containing fungicide to do that, something that's labeled for an edible fruit crop. Always have to be careful when you're applying things to something that's edible that it says on the label of the product that you're selecting that you can apply it to an edible crop. Some products are only labeled for ornamentals. But oftentimes a single application, either in the fall or in the spring, or you can potentially do both a fall application and a spring application, and that'll oftentimes knock back the fungus to the point where you won't have really severe disease. You might have to do that a couple of years running just to eventually get it under control. Also hope for a little bit drier spring, because again, if we have a really wet spring, that's going to promote the production of spores by this fungus that will infect the leaves and cause that weird deformed look to the leaf tissue.
Yeah. Eric, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Brian Huddleston, our guest director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. On Monday's program, we'll take a look at 50 years of Saturday Night Live with a local podcaster. We'll also talk to the director of a Christmas romance movie that was filmed in Door County, and then we'll take a look at some of this year's fall movie releases. That's all coming up on Monday. Right now, looking at plant diseases with Brian Huddleston. And again, join in 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Phil in, he was in River Falls, emailed he has many hard maples that he transplanted to his property in the early 90s. And over the years, been a good growth and healthy trees. The last 4 years, he's had a few random trees dying over a period of a couple of years. And also just this summer, one had white fungus on a large area of the trunk. And this one appears to have died, losing all its leaves in early September. Ideas on what may be causing these trees to die?
Could be multiple problems. I mentioned verticillium wilt previously. That is a disease that maples have problems with. Some exceptions, silver maple tends not to get verticillium wilt, but most other maples can. So that's potentially an issue. Up in that area of the state, as we get a little bit farther north, there is a disease called armillaria root disease. It's another fungal disease. This fungus is a mushroom producer, so it produces what are called honey mushrooms. And so if you see clusters of mushrooms around the base of the trees that have died, that's potentially could be what the problem is. Another thing I've been seeing more of on maples recently, again, I think because of wet weather we've had, have been root rot issues that are causing trees to decline. And those, oftentimes the pathogens will stay in the root system, but I've been seeing progression of a particular pathogen called Phytophthora up into the trunks of the trees so that you actually get what are called bleeding cankers. So you get these oozy areas. So that could be another possibility if he's seeing oozy areas on the trunk. The whitish growth that he's seeing, if it's kind of flat and kind of, rough looking, there is a fungus called Urpex lacteus. The common name is the milky white tooth polypore. It's a somewhat opportunistic pathogen in that it will get into the trees through some sort of wound. So that could be a frost crack or some physical injury to the tree. Once it gets in, it can colonize the bark and it will cause a wood rot and sap rot of the tree. It will kill off the water conducting tissue. And that causes, will produce kind of a layer of this, like I said, kind of whitish, can be kind of yellow, creamy color as well, but very kind of rough looking growth on the trees. So those are some things that it could possibly be. Again, sending in photos or a sample might be needed in order to really get a good idea of exactly what's going on.
Makes sense. Nancy and Teresa called to ask if she can put wood ash on her garden beds.
Yeah, you can, but you have to be kind of careful with that because of the nutrient composition of that particular material. I don't know if it's still available, but if you go to the Horticulture Extension website again, there used to be a fact sheet on using wood ash in the garden. Mm-hmm. And you might do a search on that and see if you can find that particular fact sheet.
Yeah,
the details on how to use it. And oftentimes you'll probably want to do a soil nutrient test before you use that material, just so that you don't incorporate excessive ash and up certain nutrients to the point where they might be toxic.
Yeah, makes good sense. Southern blight was also a problem this year, was it not? Or at least somewhat of a problem?
Yeah, that's going to be in my top 10 for the year, I think, because I saw probably about a half a dozen cases of that this year. That may not sound like a lot, but for me in the clinic to get that many of a particular disease show up, that's a lot for me. And this is another fungal disease. It's probably the nastiest fungal disease that I deal with. It's quite an aggressive pathogen, very broad spectrum. Basically, if you're an herbaceous plant in the path of this fungus, you're dead. It will kill off pretty much anything that's herbaceous. I see it often come in on samples of hostas, so that somebody's hosta plant is dying back. It looks like the crown is rotting. And then what I look for is that the fungus, as it kind of ages, will produce these roughly spherical kind of tannish color resting structures called sclerotia. They look kind of like those Osmocote pellet fertilizer beads that you can get to fertilize your garden. And it's a resting structure, helps the organism survive. If you see this, you have to be very aggressive in terms of the treatment. I tell folks to kind of go out into the area where you see the plants dying, kind of delimit the edge of where those plants are dead, and then also look for any of those little sclerotia, those little spherical structures. They may form on the mulch. So kind of go out and find the outer edge of where you think the disease is, then go about 3 feet beyond that, and then have big, thick mill garbage bags next to you and start digging out everything from the edge of that area back towards the center and bag it up and take it to your local landfill to get rid of it. And then not only do you take out the plants, but I would take out probably the top 2 to 3 inches of soil as well to just try to get rid of as much of that fungus as you possibly can. And you need to be very careful to clean off the soles of your shoes. If you have a wheelbarrow that you're using to clean off the wheel, anything that comes into contact with the soil, clean your tools. Using things like 70% alcohol, that'll work relatively well against this particular organism, because you can move this pathogen around, particularly if you're moving those sclerotia around. And it's a tough disease. It's one of the few diseases where I actually do make a recommendation to use fungicides after the fact in the area where you've had a problem. Certainly after you replant, there are certain fungicides that you can use to treat, to try to knock back this organism and prevent it from being a problem. And again, if you want to read more on southern blight, we have a fact sheet on that that's available at my website.
Yeah. I'm wondering, are you seeing damage from our lack of snow from last winter yet? I just wonder about if that makes it vulnerable to diseases.
Yeah, we get a lot of physical damage from that. What happens when you don't have a lot of snow cover is snow actually insulates the soil, so it prevents the soil temperatures from going excessively low. So if you've got a nice layer of snow, probably the soil temperatures beneath that are going to be in the upper 20s or so during the wintertime. But if we don't have a snow cover, then those soil temperatures can go down into the teens, and that will be physically damaging to root systems of plants, and that can lead above ground to a lot of branch dieback and can actually kill trees in certain instances and shrubs and other types of plants. And then if that damage doesn't totally kill the plant, it can provide entry points for other problems, disease-causing organisms. It can get in through those wounds and then cause additional damage. So it was a real problem this past year because we had a very open winter where we didn't have much snow.
Do we want to be thinking about putting down a mulch, after the ground freezes?
That can be helpful in certain situations. I think a better hope is that we have some snow this year, good 3, 4, 5 inches of snow, nice insulation to keep things in that, have that through most of the wintertime just to help keep things insulated and keep it a little warmer.
Pilar in Madison emailed, she has a couple of Penstemon digitalis Husker Red plants, which have developed a pretty severe case of spotted leaves the last couple of years. They have still bloomed in the spring, but then declined over the growing season. She attached a few photos taken in July, in case this is relevant. One plant is near a climbing rose, and another is near a pinion knee. The rose also has some leaf spotting, but it doesn't look the same. The peony is fine and healthy. Any idea what this is?
It's probably one of the fungal leaf spots, and this is one of the situations where, in order to tell exactly which pathogen it is, I need to see a sample in the clinic, because most of the time when I'm IDing pathogens, I need to use a microscope. I have to look for fungal spores and identify the pathogen based on that. Could also be a bacterial disease, although my first guess would be it's a fungal leaf spot of some kind or another. Typically, with fungal leaf spots, the main controls are good cleanup of the material from last year that's infected. Get that out of the garden before your plants sprout in the spring, because that's where the pathogens will hang out over the winter time. And again, that material typically can be burned where it's allowed, deep buried, or composted. And then other things would be to open up airflow, so some thinning around the plants to get better air penetration, which will increase drying. The plants will dry more rapidly, and fungal pathogens require periods where the leaves are wet in order for infection to occur. So those are a couple of things. If it's too bad, there might be some fungicide treatments that I could recommend. But again, I would need to see a sample to see exactly which fungus is involved before I would make a fungicide recommendation. So again, if the person is interested, they can check out my website and submit a sample.
Linda in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Hi. My question is regarding rust on sunflowers. And I planted sunflowers last year, didn't have any problem with the fungus, but this year it was just horrendous. And I've read where the fungus will overwinter. So if I plant sunflowers again next year, do I have to worry about the fungus returning?
Yeah, most likely, yes. I'm trying to think whether I think that's a single host rust, as I recall. Some rusts require two different hosts in order to complete their life cycles. Others, only one type of plant. And I believe the sunflower, if it is truly sunflower rust, there are other fungal diseases that could be as well. But all of those, whether it's rust or one of the other fungal diseases, they tend to survive in old plant debris from your sunflowers. So you may be very diligent about trying to clean up your old plants, but you'll still probably leave at least some leaf debris that'll filter down into the soil and will harbor the pathogen over the wintertime, and then it'll sporulate in the spring and cause additional infections in your new plants. So if you want to try to grow sunflowers next year, my first inclination would be to try to move them to a new site as far away from where you had them last year as possible, or maybe even hold off for a year and allow things to kind of decline naturally, and then try replanting again. But I wouldn't really replant on that area where you've had a problem. There's just too much risk of carryover of the pathogen that will cause additional problems in subsequent years. So sometimes just not planting the susceptible plant for a few years is the best option for getting these diseases under control. Allows natural dieback of the pathogen, although oftentimes the pathogens can be blown back in on winds, so
sure,
that doesn't totally take care of the problem. These are pesky little organisms, quite frankly. You do everything you possibly can, and sometimes you don't get any control. And this past year has been particularly bad because, again, we had so much rain in so many areas of Wisconsin that it was just perfect for these organisms.
And on that note, Brian, I want to thank you once again for being with us. It's always a pleasure, and I'll look forward to your next visit. Thanks, Brian.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Larry.
Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. Big thanks to him. Big thanks to our crew members, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to Garden Talk, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.